Sexy Gary.
Salut, ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT 90,3 FM.
What's up, good people? To those of you listening wherever, whenever, whatever time it is, good morning, good evening, and good night. You are locked into another Tuesday evening with Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Soul P has been on the air since 1994. We bring you all the topics, the guests, the ups and downs, the highs and the lows of the black community here in Montreal, across Canada, and internationally. We have a beautiful evening of music and discussion lined up for you tonight. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives right here on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial.
Sitting here, guess I didn't make bail. Got time and a story to tell. Started when I was 9 years old. Woke up and daddy was gone. I started hustling, they couldn't tell me nothing. Frontin' in the hood, trying to be somebody. My soul was on empty. I was searching for something. Tried to be good. Tried to keep from trouble. Living too fast, trying to make good on a hustle. Sometimes it get rough.
Coming from where I'm from.
Times got hard, yeah.
Coming from where I'm from.
Sometimes they gotta walk to work, yeah.
Coming from where I'm from.
Sometimes you gotta do a little dirt. Wasn't really looking, guess I found it. 5'3", light brown skin. Coming from the university. Night style, looking kinda lovely. Didn't know she had much game. Down to ride out, even take the train. Even took her to a poker game. Top notch, fried chicken and sushi. Try to be good. Tried to treat you like a lady. Tried to be your friend. Turned out that you were shady. Sometimes I get lonely.
Coming from where I'm from.
Things ain't what they seem to be.
Coming from where I'm from.
Sometimes you get a little angry. Yeah.
Coming from where I'm from.
Sometimes you get the best of me.
Yes, we're back. It's another Tuesday evening, and you are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and tonight's guest is no stranger to the show, no stranger to Montreal. He is a spoken word artist, he is a youth worker, and more importantly than that, the best title that he has right now is he is a black father and an advocate for mental health. Jason Steele Joseph. I don't know if you still go by that moniker, but that's the moniker that I knew you.
I kind of changed the Steele to Steele Poet.
Okay.
And I've also been going a lot with my middle name professionally. So Jason Andy Joseph.
All right.
And like when I sign my poetry and stuff like that, I put Jason Steele Poet Joseph. But yeah, Steele is good.
We'll go with the moniker that you have. So it's Steele Poet, Jason Steele Thank Poet you. Joseph. Thank you so much for being here, brother. It's really a pleasure to have you. So like what we've been doing since, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic still, and I don't even know, like, do we say the middle? Do we say, are we 2/3? Are we almost done? Are we at the end? We like to check in with people and see, you know, what's going on? How are you doing? How's this pandemic been affecting you? And I know you have a family, your partner, and you have 3 kids. So that's a very unique kind of situation going on for you.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's, I guess, kind of a mixture of both good and bad. When the pandemic began for us here in Montreal, well, in Canada, I should say, and then we were in lockdown and everything, you know, there was that quiet time when nobody was going to work. We were home with the kids. My wife was home. I was home. We actually got better financially.
Okay.
There weren't a lot of things to spend on because we weren't going to work a lot. So I didn't have to buy like bus pass, certain types of things. We learned to cut more corners financially. I thought that was a good aspect of it all.
So you didn't go out and buy like 2,000 rolls of toilet tissue?
No, I didn't do any of that. Because you know what? It's funny because that first week, I saw people buying out the toilet paper and all this stuff. And I'm like, but if you just buy what you need, you know, everybody will have enough. There'll be enough for everybody.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I missed out on the hand sanitizer. Like, I really wished I had some of that because it was gone from everywhere. And, you know, so I had to wash my hands most of the time, but that wasn't a big deal. But yeah, I didn't bother going out and buying out a whole bunch of stuff. You know, I just bought what we needed and we got along fine. I really had nothing to complain about. It was a very quiet time. You know, we took a lot of drives. We drove to neighboring towns in the greater Montreal area, discovered some new places that we've never been to before. We spent a lot of time together in the house. You know, we watched movies, we played games, those kinds of things. So we got kind of closer as a family. We spent so much time together.
Yeah.
My wife was working from home. Me, if I'm not at work, there's really nothing to do because my job involves me working with my students. So I basically sat at home most of the time and, you know, did things with the kids and the usual stuff, cleaning. You know, it was very quiet downtime, so it was kind of relaxing.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, there was the scare of the pandemic as well.
Yeah.
And the mental health issues were really going up. My wife, you know my wife, Val, she has a panic disorder.
Okay.
And I noticed around that time, that's when, so it was around, I think around close to spring when we
yeah, ended it was, up, it was right lockdown. At the beginning of spring. It was about March 16th. Yeah. It was March 16th. It was March 16th, exactly. The first day of the pandemic.
And I noticed, more later that year, going into the winter, when we had already gone back to work, I had gone back to work, that's when I thought, you know, our mental health issues were getting even more pressing.
Okay.
Yeah, my wife was having panic attacks like every day. They were really, really bad. Like, really bad. Okay. Sometimes I had to take days off and just to stay with her because, you know, the thing with panic attacks and me, I don't have a panic disorder, but I've had issues with panic attacks. Okay. Very rare. And not as heavy as my wife, but it's like you need someone to be there with you because you always think, you think that you're going to die. You think it's the worst of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like you think
your family members are gonna die. It's always worst case scenario.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So there were times I was just afraid to even go to work. I just wanted to stay with her, just make sure she was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I was diagnosed with depression, I think 2 years before that.
Right.
And, yeah, I thought my depression was, you know, starting to get the better of me. The darkness was coming in kind of thing. And, that was pretty tough to deal with. So, yeah, just trying to take care of ourselves. And I was doing a lot more walking, trying to exercise, eat right. It was just a mixture of all kinds of things, you know, like the good thing about the pandemic was, you know, being home, it helped you to sort of think about what you want to do.
Okay.
With life or with work, with business, projects, things like that.
Yeah.
So a lot of ideas were coming because of that. I also lost a huge contract because of the pandemic.
Okay.
I was supposed to be a speaker at a school, and it would have been my biggest contract.
Okay.
Not my first, I would say, but probably my biggest contract. And yeah, then the pandemic happened, so they had to cancel it.
Okay.
And I wasn't upset about it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these days I'm of the mindset that if something doesn't really work out, something else will come up.
Yeah.
You know,
as you say in Jamaican terms, what I feel can't unfeel.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
What's meant for you is going to be yours, and what's not meant for you is going to keep on moving.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. You said it. So, yeah, just stay positive and say, you know, other things will come up. Not just sitting there waiting for things to come up, but, you know, if you put yourself in situations, things will happen.
And think just outside like, the box as well. There's other ways to
exactly
to do things.
You know, a lot of that pertains to what we're doing right now. I decided, you know, that I would start doing videos on Instagram. Some people are taking notice. And so through that video came the opportunity of me sitting down with you today.
Yeah.
You know, and doing this this talk. So yeah, you just gotta get yourself out there, you know. So that's I guess some of the good stuff the pandemic has brought. The only bad thing would be, I guess, the mental health issues. You know, like it's heightened a lot for us. I'm back on medication again.
Okay.
Earlier this past summer, I started to feel the depression creeping in.
Right.
So I called my doctor and talked with him for a bit. He prescribed some meds for me. So I've been taking that. Things have been fine since. The only issue was just trying to find the right time to take the meds. So I played around with it for a bit. So I decided to take them at night. When I've already eaten.
Okay.
And it starts to make me feel a little bit better about whatever it is I'm going to do, especially for the next day, and have that energy
again.
Keep going. And eventually I'll come off of them, you know, once things start to get a little better. So we'll see what happens. That's just another story.
Yeah, that's definitely another story. If you don't mind my asking, like, what does the medication do scientifically, because you say you have depression, and so like how can medication affect the depression to make it better?
Yeah, it could. The medication could give you that boost that you need. You know, like especially when you're in the process of not doing anything to get those natural endorphins that you need.
Okay.
To that feeling of happiness, that feeling of feeling just good.
So like dopamine and oxytocin?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So what that was doing, at first I was like, I was feeling down, feeling dark, like I didn't want to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want to go out and walk. Didn't want to get up and shower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, didn't want to get up and eat sometimes. So the medication helps me to just get going.
Yeah.
And when I last spoke with my doctor, he told me, have you started exercising yet? And I had told him no at the time. But he goes, I want you to start exercising, because once you start exercising, you'll create the naturalness of it all to make you feel better. And then eventually you can get off the meds.
Right.
So, so I started walking, doing little things here and there, starting very small, because I've had those issues in the past where you just try to do too much all at once.
Too much, too fast.
And, exactly. And then you end up dropping everything and then going back into that hole
mm-hmm.
that you tried to get yourself out of.
Yeah.
So I'm actually very blessed that my doctor wants me to get off the meds. I've never been a firm believer in meds, but ever since I've been diagnosed with depression, I've seen where meds could help me.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, when I was first prescribed the meds after my diagnosis, I knew eventually I would get off of them. So I took them for maybe 3/4 of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I spoke to my doctor and I said, is it okay to come off it now? And he goes, well, what's your lifestyle like? What have you been doing? At the time I was eating right. I was exercising more. And he's like, okay, I don't mind. He goes, start cutting back on your dosage. So I was taking one pill at the time. So he would like say, okay, take half for about a week. And then after that, just stop it at that point.
Okay.
So weaning myself off.
Right.
Eventually, once I start getting myself rolling and everything, exercising more, I already have an idea of what I want to do as far as exercising is concerned, but I can't just jump right into it because the scheme that I have in my head is just, it's not feasible.
Right.
Yet.
Right.
what I see. So got to start small, start slow, and then work my way up there. And then when I get to that point, I'll know when, you know, I need to ask my doctor to get off. So I'm trying to be responsible at the same time.
Okay. Yeah. So coming back to this video that I saw that prompted me to ask you to do this interview with me today, you had actually said, because you just said right now that 2 years before the pandemic, you were diagnosed with depression. But you said in that video that you had been going, that a friend of yours reminded you that you had been going to therapy since 2006.
Yes, yes.
Which is interesting because, like, I myself, I also went to therapy that specific year, mm-hmm. The end of that year. And I was wondering, why did you decide to go into therapy? And you know, like your friend said, that's something that not a lot of Black men do, at least they don't speak openly about it. I want us to stop saying that Black men don't do this. I think we just don't speak about it. Because I think
this is true.
Because when we get together and we start talking, we realize, hey, but you actually been to see a therapist? Yeah, I've been to see a therapist. And we talk amongst each other when we get into certain kind of, settings. But out there, nobody really knows what we're doing. We just kind of keep it to ourselves.
True.
But yeah.
Yeah.
So how come you went to, you sought therapy back in 2006?
Well, I was having a lot of issues. I was having a lot of daddy issues.
Okay.
My parents were divorced when I was like maybe 4 years old. I developed this habit of trying to impress my father, to the point where, I picked up a lot of his habits, you know, running around with all kinds of women and thinking that this was okay.
Right.
You know, because the community that I was growing up in, if you were the type of guy who had a lot of women, you were the type of guy who was like considered a man.
Right.
You know, so these are things that I thought would make me a man. But you know, the funny thing is, I was never, I realized through the therapy that I was never really that guy. Like, that was never me. For years and years, I was putting up this persona that did not match the person that I was. And so I got caught up in it all. And I guess I got a lot, very confused, and angry at my dad a lot. You know, hanging out all hours of the night, doing all kinds of stupid things and being, unfaithful to especially a lot of, well, my girlfriends at the time or whoever I was dating. My wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, we had just moved in together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was dealing with a lot of this nonsense and I always just wanted to change.
Yeah.
You know, so, she recommended therapy to me. And it just so happened that one of her college professors was a psychotherapist. His name is Vadney Haynes. He's also a playwright, actually. He wrote for a play, and it was presented at the Black Theater Workshop at the My Center.
Oh, wow.
Blackstone Bowl.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't see that one, but okay.
Yeah. So, he was my therapist for, I guess, about three, maybe 4 years,
mm-hmm.
until he retired. And I saw him for maybe 2.5 years before I had like a major breakthrough. And I say major breakthrough, like that moment when the clouds just like part, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But there were like little victories in there as well.
Yeah.
So it's not all like a waste of time, you know. One time I was in his office, like I said, about 2.5 years after seeing him, and I was venting about my father, and then he goes at the end of the meeting, "Okay, so it's time to talk to your dad." And I was like, what do you mean? Talk to my dad. You know, like the boy started coming out of me at that point.
Right.
And he's like, "You need to tell your dad how you feel."
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Okay, if you say so." So one day I'm sitting in my apartment and I just picked up the phone and called him.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think about it because I didn't want to change my mind. I said, "This is what Fanny said to do. So I'm going to do it." My dad came over. I vented to him. I cried like a baby because it just needed to be said. And after that moment, it was done. Like the resentment, the anger, the animosity, whatever all that was gone. And till this day, you know, like I'm still surprised, you know, like at how quickly after venting and just saying what I had to say to my dad,
mm-hmm.
you know, like all that stuff lifted. from that point on, my changes were more rapid than before. The thing is, when I started seeing my therapist, I was leaving his office very often, like, broken.
Right.
Because you can attest to this. You hear a lot of truths in this office.
Yeah.
You know, just you and this one person talking.
Yeah.
And you're saying all these things that you've never heard yourself say before. You've heard yourself say it in your head, but hearing it in your head is totally different than actually saying it.
But even if you said it out loud, right? Sometimes even saying it out loud to friends is different from saying it to a therapist who can in that hour or 2 hours that you're with them, or hour and a half, break down and analyze what you've said and then throw it right back at you and say, well, these are the issues that you're facing and these are the things that you need to address. It's a completely different thing. Yeah. We do have to take a quick break. Just in case you're tuning in for the first time, we are talking to Jason Joseph, who is a spoken word artist known as Steel Poet. He's a youth worker, and more importantly, he's a Black father. He's also become, in these years, a mental health advocate. But we got to take a quick break, pay some bills, keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Mama, I made it. Papa, I made it. Through the pebbles and the storm, I learned to carry on. You have done has helped me overcome. Mama, I made it. Papa, I made it.
Yo, mince meat, brother. I am on my grind. I got these weak dudes dipping like a limbo line. 514, now's about my time. Words of Dr. Frankenstein. He's screaming I'm alive. And so well, like a bucket and a rope in it. Obama swagger, put the change and the hope in it. Hold the flow down like a news anchor. Do it heavily medicated, so now I'm giving dope music. I'm not a rapper, I'm a general up in the movement. And what I value most, I can never lose it. See, radiation, hardest 5 weeks of my life. And there is no harder other brother on the mic. So I give them what they need, they so what they like. And when you hear it, it's like riding a bike. You hesitate at first, then remember how it's done. Cause it's classic, but it's fresh, and it's smart, and it's fun.
I made it, Papa, I made it. Through the pebbles and the storm, I learned to carry on. And everything that you have done has helped me overcome. Mama, I made it, Papa, I made it.
And I radiate like a star. I'm so driven, I am whipping more than your car. Words epic, floating back like Star Wars. Hospital ward, IV was on my cord. I break a weak dude like a paradigm. They say I'm too complex when I write a rhyme. I'm just well read. Stop sign, E got clipped, so you can never black shine. Plow. And frankly, dude, if you don't feel, you don't feel, and you ain't real, so don't come around. No syndrome, homes, I am not down. Come through flashing like a photo light. I'm the future, like a prototype. Hype, and I wasn't born a right. I was born a love, I was born a fight.
I made it, Papa, I made it. Through the pebbles and the storm, I learned to carry on. And everything that you have done has helped me overcome. Mama, I made it. Papa, I made it. Magenta, I made it. Junior, I made it. Through the pebbles and the storm, I learned to carry on.
Radiation. Radiation. Sarah's excited to celebrate her birthday at a restaurant. She's thought about it all week. She invited her friends. She got a new dress. She went to the restaurant. She wasn't allowed in the restaurant. She had to put away her new dress. She couldn't see her friends. And she thought about it all week.
Don't wait until it hits you. Get vaccinated. A vaccination passport is now required to enter certain public spaces. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
We are back once again. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and on the air we have Jason Steel Poet Joseph, who is a spoken word artist, a youth worker, a black father, and has become of late a mental health advocate, especially for black men and black people in general, to, you know, take care of their mental health. Jason, before the break, you were speaking about, you know, when back in 2006 you decided that, you know, you wanted to make a change with your life because you didn't like the direction that you were going in at the time, and you finally had a breakthrough about 2.5 years into therapy, and you said that you spoke to your father and you were able to kind of shed. As a spoken word artist myself, I'll use a different metaphor than what you said, but you shed a load that you had been carrying on your back. And yes, from there on, you were able to just kind of go through, part through the water and just kind of blossom a little bit more. Tell us a little bit more about, like, because now you're a father, right? Mm-hmm. And you have three beautiful children. How has, you know, going through that therapy and having that breakthrough, how has that shaped your view as of fatherhood now?
Wow.
Because a lot of the time we either do one of two things. We emulate our parents, or we deviate completely from our parents. Yes. So there's always a spectrum, but you know, usually we fall somewhere on one of the other sides of the spectrum, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse.
True. I noticed that I do have some traits of my parents still. So I try to get myself to notice them. Like my son, like my kids will do things sometimes and I'll be like, don't do that. What are you doing that for? And you know, when our parents would tell us not to do things and not explain why, yes, this was of more a back in the day type thing, I guess. So now I try to explain. I try not to, it's funny. It's a funny thing because sometimes kids will naturally get on our nerves.
Of course.
You know what I mean? Naturally. So I really try not to, I really try just to keep calm with them. The thing is with my depression, sometimes, I tend to, how would I say, blow things out of proportion.
Yeah.
Like one day my son ate a whole bunch of the clementines that I had just bought.
Right.
And I almost lost it. And my wife had to grab my arm and I deflated like a balloon. And I walked away. So I find myself walking away from a lot of things, picking my battles, just trying not to deal with everything, which is hard for me.
Right.
I'm very, how should I say? I'm very particular. Mm. Things have to be done a certain way.
Okay.
When my kids...
In other words, you're a Caribbean man.
Yeah, exactly. Things have to be done a certain way. And if it's not done a certain way, I'm getting on them for it, but I catch myself.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that's different for me and my parents. I catch myself and I apologize a lot.
Okay.
A lot. Because it's the right thing to do. And if they see that I'm apologizing, they'll see that it's okay to apologize to people when, you know, when you do wrong.
When you do wrong, yeah.
Yeah, and taking ownership of your mistakes.
Yes.
So, and the thing is, I've watched my mom grow as a parent too. She was 19 when I was born.
Okay. Young mom.
Yeah, yeah. And married and divorced probably by the time she was in her early 20s.
Yeah.
So I saw an anger in my mom when I was younger. However, when she started to educate herself, I remember she went to school, she got her high school diploma, she went to Vanier, she went to Concordia. I saw her change as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
By the time she was in Vanier, I was already in high school.
Right.
By the time I got to CEGEP, I think she was in university at the time.
Wow.
But I saw her be less angry. I think the whole deal with my dad leaving, my dad being the person that he was at the time, was very hard to deal with for her.
Yeah.
There was a lot of anger on her part that I had seen. My mom is a very spiritual person. She likes to read spiritual books, things like that. She's also taught me to read a lot of those things as well. We're not very big Bible readers.
Okay.
But we like to read books like Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, Acts of Faith, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And those are things that I read to my students today. Mm-hmm. I do that every morning with them. And we read that so that way I can give them some positivity to go off into the day and something to think about throughout the day. The thing is, with those books, I've watched my mom like really, really, how should I say, get to the level that she wants to be at.
Right.
As a mother, as a woman, as a professional, as a person. So that was a good influence on me because I adopted a lot of that as well. I don't want to talk about my dad like he's a bad person. My dad is a very good guy.
Okay.
Some guys are just not great fathers.
Yeah.
You know, and I look at my dad's life before me. He had it very tough.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, his mom had moved to London, England when he was still very young. And she left him in Grenada,
wow,
where my family's from.
Mm-hmm.
So his grandparents raised him. Grandparents were very tough on their grandkids back in those days, especially in the islands. And I don't know, you could attest to that as well.
Mm.
So there was a sense of abandonment there.
Yeah. Abandonment is a huge issue,
yes.
especially for descendants of slaves.
Oh yeah.
Because
definitely.
I mean that was the crux of what colonialism did to the black families and black people who came from Africa. Is they made sure that they separated us from one another in terms of families, in terms
exactly.
of tribes. So that is ingrained in us that we're going to constantly be separated from one another.
Exactly.
So abandonment exactly. is huge in when it comes to mental health disorders, and we don't even acknowledge it. We don't even understand it. We don't even realize what all of that does to us.
Exactly. So looking at all that stuff, I could totally understand how my dad feels. I totally understand what he's going through.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not experience-wise because I wasn't there, but it's, I mean, as a young man to, as a young boy to be left like that. And his father is my grandfather, Mato is his name, is rumored to have like over 20 kids from Barbados to Grenada, Trinidad, you know, so like,
oh my goodness.
So, you know, this is the cycle I was caught up in.
Right.
My dad got caught up in it. I got caught up in it. So I had to just break that cycle.
Yeah.
That was the biggest thing for me. And going back to saying that, you know, my dad is not all that a bad guy. He really isn't. He was given a bad deal as a young man. The thing is, my dad could use a lot of that therapy that I've been going to.
Right.
That would be great for him. The thing is, my dad's in his 70s now. So, like, those guys, they don't really care about that stuff right now.
No. You know,
their minds are elsewhere. And like you said, it's so ingrained within them that getting out is like almost impossible.
Yeah.
And I say almost.
Trying to break down 70 years of life for like what, another 10 years?
Exactly.
They don't see the point at this point in time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he's a great guy. He always gives me good advice. Was proud of the person that I am, that I decided to, you know, not hang out on the corner and sell drugs. And I went to school. It was always important for me to get that education. And hey, back then I was always playing basketball and hanging out with my friends. And, you know, I was always a positive type kid. So if I were to ever go down that road, that would be, I guess, surprising now that I look at it, but it never turned out that way. And my dad's always been proud of that. So, you know, looking back on everything now, you know, I'm so glad that that I was able to let go of whatever it was that I had, that I can sit down with my father and you know, just be cool with him. You know, I look at my kids and I'm like, I'm already giving them something different. Like my son, I look at him, my eldest son, mm-hmm. and I tell him all the time. I said, "You're already a better person than I was at your age." And the thing is, I was still a good kid.
Yeah.
The thing is, I was always running around, not doing homework, and causing trouble with friends and things like that. You know, nothing serious.
That most kids do. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Run up and down, go through the back alleys, have little mini adventures, do your mini Indiana Jones exploring, pretending that you're superheroes, jumping off of balconies, and kind of horse dead and cow fat.
I'm saying. So my son hasn't had all that. He's, you know, they're growing up in the technology era. So going outside would benefit him, which he does still. He plays outside with his friends, which I'm very surprised at, because not a lot of kids are doing it these days.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm already looking at him and I'm like, he has a father who, you know, has a career, who, you know, who has something that he can look forward to. Who doesn't run around on his mother. You know, all of these things, they're very important. And I'm very loving with my wife in front of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I want them to see that. I want them to know that. I love my wife dearly. So what better way to show that in front of my son? You know, how are you going to treat the woman that you're going to deal with in the future? And for my daughter to see how a man should be treating her.
Right.
So this whole thing with parenting, I always knew that I would possibly be a good father. I'm just so glad that I did all the therapy and everything before Loic was born. Because now that I have all that, you know, I can practice a lot of the positivity and all of the things that I've learned and pass that on to him as well.
Yeah.
And my youngest son, Max, as well, who has Down syndrome.
Okay. Just in case you're tuning in for the first time, we are speaking to Jason, steel poet Joseph, who is a spoken word artist, a youth worker, a black father, an advocate for mental health. He's just all of the good things right now. We do have to take a quick break and pay some bills and play some music. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Back once again. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and you are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. On the air with us tonight, we are speaking to Jason, steel poet Joseph, who is a spoken word artist, youth worker, black father, and a mental health advocate. And before the break, you dropped a little nugget on us, and you spoke to us about your son, and your youngest son, who has yes. Down syndrome. Tell us a little bit about that, because I know, like, from myths from maybe 40, 50, 60 or even more years ago, Down syndrome was seen as something that was very horrific, Some people said it had, you were touched by demons. There are all kinds of myths and superstitions with regards to Down syndrome. What exactly is Down syndrome? Well, as you've come to learn it, learn about it.
Yes. The medical term for Down syndrome is actually trisomy 21. It's when there's a third copy of your 21st chromosome. So it's a condition. It's a condition that happens when you have a copy of your 21st chromosome, and there's a difference around the eyes, smaller ears, hands maybe a little bit smaller, tongue is heavier. The child doesn't develop as quickly, but as on time as most children do.
Okay.
When we found out that Max was Down syndrome, Val, my wife, was 5 months pregnant.
Okay.
So we had to do an amniocentesis to figure out the diagnosis. After that, we got the diagnosis, excuse me. And the muscles of the child, they told us, won't develop as normally. Mm-hmm. So they were trying to prepare us for the fact that the child might not be moving in the womb.
Okay.
The thing is, Max was moving all over the place.
Right.
So I guess they told us that just for us not to get our hopes up.
Okay. Or to give you the worst case scenario.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So Max was moving in the womb a lot. When he was actually born, some of the nurses asked, does he really have Down syndrome? Because he's moving a lot. Max was just very lucky.
Mm-hmm.
He was born with no heart problems, no digestive issues, which are issues that usually affect children with Down syndrome.
Okay.
So he was very lucky on that point. And it was very, I remember finding out for the first time, it was very, very scary.
Yeah.
Very upsetting. You're wondering, what did you do?
Yeah.
Why?
What did you do wrong?
Why is this happening?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Did I do something wrong? Was it me? My wife's thinking the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
What could we have done differently? All these things going through our head.
Yeah.
So just to find out more about Down syndrome, I went on YouTube. YouTube is like the biggest tool for me to find anything that I need to know.
Yeah.
And the funny thing, Kim, this father pops up on the screen of the video that I chose. And he says, so you're having a child with Down syndrome and you're wondering what you did wrong. That's the first thing he said. And I was like, okay, this guy's talking to me.
Right.
So he's talking and he's telling us the story about when he found out him and his wife were going to have a child with Down syndrome, how they felt, what it was like after their child was born, and what it was like when their child was growing. And one of the things that he said that really, it didn't resonate with me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it sort of resonated with me over time.
Yeah.
Because I heard it a few more times after. He said, sit back and watch the magic.
Okay.
So I didn't understand what that meant at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember about 2 or 3 months after Max was born, Val and I went out to dinner with some friends. And one of those friends said, oh, so you have a magic baby. And I was like, there's that word magic again.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps coming up. So I'm thinking about this word magic over time. And I think Max started walking when he was about 3.
Okay.
'Cause like I said, the development is very slow.
Okay.
Like very slow. And it's a good thing he was our third child, because it's the first child where you're worrying about the milestones all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When is he going to wave? How come he's not walking yet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these things you get so worried about as a parent when it's your first child.
Yeah.
So this one's our third. So we're like, okay, we already know he's not going to develop normally. So let's just be patient.
Yeah.
For whatever comes, whatever comes. So Max started walking at 3. And I picked him up at daycare and he was walking. And the ladies at the daycare were like, oh, yeah, he's been walking like all day. Like, it's nothing to them.
Right.
You know, but here I am like, wow. So I brought him to pick up his brother and sister. He walked down the hall to meet them. They were like, oh, my God, he's walking. I brought him home. And Val stayed by the stairs. And there's a walkway to get down to our house.
Yeah.
And she videotaped it. And Max walked all the way up to her. And when he got about maybe 6 feet away, he clapped for himself. And
nice.
That was the magic.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain. And I guess you sort of have to be there. But he does these little things that just make him so amazing. One story I could tell you, I was videotaping him. And you know me, I'm a huge comic book fan already.
Right.
So I was watching Batman, the animated series, and Max was watching it with me.
Mm-hmm.
But he's standing in front of the TV. And there was another child that was in the house at the time, my wife's friend's son.
Mm-hmm.
He's about 2 years younger than Max.
Right.
He's trying to reach for this toy car on the coffee table. And I'm videotaping this whole thing, not even realizing what I'm doing. Because I just like to videotape Max, whatever he's doing. Max could be standing still, I'm videotaping him.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, this little boy is reaching for the car on the coffee table.
Right.
And then Max turns around and sees what he's trying to reach for. So Max takes the car and gives it to the boy.
Right.
And then the boy just goes away. But I didn't even notice this. It was when I played the video back later that night with Val. I saw it, and no lie, tears just came to my eyes.
Right.
So that's even some more magic. My kids came in the room like, Papa, you're crying? What are you crying for? I never seen you cry before. This and that.
Yeah.
But these things, just that alone, that gesture alone from Max, that told me that this boy is capable. This boy is special.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is what Max has brought into our home. He's such a happy child. He loves to laugh. He makes his grandparents the happiest people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I see how his grandmother, my wife's mom, my mother-in-law, she loves to feed him, and she laughs, she grins like with him. You know, he'll be like, thank you, Grandmama. And she'll be like, this laugh within her. But I don't even know how to explain it. It's just a warm feeling that she has from him. Everybody that he's around, he infects with this magic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody loves to be around him. He was popular in his daycare. He's popular in his school now because he's in kindergarten.
Okay.
And he totally changed our lives in such a big way. It was great because when we told our family members and our friends that we were having a child with Down syndrome, everybody was just very supportive.
Right.
Everybody was just like, okay, and so what? You know, we're going to love this kid the same way,
mm-hmm.
no matter what. So family and friends, that was the biggest key for us to help us to get over the pain of having a child that's not going to be like everybody else.
Yeah. Or is it the pain or is it the fear?
I would say the fear, not the pain. Yeah. Pain was not a good word to use.
Yeah.
The fear of the unknown, the fear of your child not adding up to everybody else. And you know, as Black people, sometimes we're most of the time or all the time, we're always worried about how we're going to be discriminated against and things like that. What's going to happen when we leave the house? Mm-hmm. I'm having a child, a black child with a disability. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like a double whammy right there. So there was a lot of fear that came from that. However, ever since he's been born, you know, the people that we come into contact with, the professionals, even trying to find the right kindergarten for him to go into, it seems like everything just is magically being put into place. Trying to find a school for him, we wanted him in the French sector. The French sector had nothing.
Right.
So I applied to an English, the English board, Riverside School Board here in the South Shore. And I got a call from a lady who wanted to see Max at his daycare. She wanted permission to talk to his therapist, mm-hmm. his physiotherapist, his occupational therapist. She was the lady who was going to recruit him to go to the school that he's in now.
Right.
Which is in the English sector. So we had no qualms about it because we knew where he was going. He was wanted. They came looking for him.
Yeah.
And then when they saw him, she told Val, you know, he can come to our school. You know, we'll send you the promotional video and the paperwork and you could see what it's like. And yeah, he's been there ever since.
Right.
So, and the good thing about it too, when you have a child that has a disability, you get a pediatrician right away.
Okay.
So he gets hooked up with a pediatrician and that pediatrician decides she'll take our other two kids as well. So Max is hooking up everybody.
Right.
You know, like
right.
Max is just hooking up everybody.
Yeah.
So yeah, that it's just an amazing, amazing run so far. It's only 5 years in. It seems like 10. And yeah, I can't imagine life without this boy. He's just so amazing. He's taught me so much. Taught me how to love, how to express emotion, just how to be more emotional, especially when I need to be. Mm-hmm. You know, quit being hard all the time and closing up, and especially when you want to be emotional.
Yeah.
And trying to be hard and tough it out. You know, these things, not only just him, just through my kids in general.
Yeah.
You know, they taught me all of that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm just learning every day from them to be a better father. I still think I do a lot of things wrong. I mean, I can never do anything right. but yeah, it's still a learning experience. I'm still going because our kids are still changing. They're going through different phases.
With technology, like the way that they interact with the world is developing at a at an even higher frequency. Like, I mean,
exactly.
You and I were born around the same time period, so. Mm-hmm. So we internet came in, you know, with the dial up. The get off the internet, you're blocking up my phone kind of deal, you know. And then it quickly progressed. Like the end of the 90s, we had dial up. So you either had to have two phone lines or the phone line was blocked. And now within 23 years, we have separate internet connections, that is fiber optic cables and this, that, and next. And now instead of having cable television, we just have a TV with different apps on it. You know, your Prime Video, your Disney Plus, your Netflix. Netflix was the first one to pioneer streaming, you know, and then nothing is done in the same way. But it's a very short 20 to 25 years is a very short span of time to have evolved from dial-up internet to like high-speed fiber optic. So,
really,
so the way that kids are learning, I mean, when I think about my youth, I mean, anything that I was learning from television had to happen between 3 and 5 p.m. You know, it had the standard cartoons
from three until four, and then you had maybe like one educational thing, Sesame Street or whatever, and then you had your Saturday mornings between like 7 a.m. when you got up before all your parents were up, and then
maybe
around 11, 12, where, you know, the last PBS show, you know, that weird show that you're just like, why am I watching this? And you get off the television. But, no, children are evolving at a higher rate now, I feel.
Yes.
And the information is coming at them much, much quicker. Wow, the time is going. We're already in need of going to another break. Just in case you're tuning in for the first time, we're speaking to Jason Steele, poet Joseph, who is a spoken word artist, a youth worker, a black father, and a mental health advocate. We are going to take a quick break. Keep it locked. You are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Back once again, one more time, the last time for the evening, just in case you're tuning in for the first time. It is, you are listening to Soul Perspectives here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and on the air with us we have a spoken word artist, a youth worker, a mental health advocate, and a proud black father, Jason Steele, poet Joseph. Jason, it's been a pleasure to have you on the air with us. Now, I've been introducing and reintroducing you to the people whenever they're listening. And at the top of the show, you know, how we met was through poetry. Tell us a little bit about how you came to poetry and how that has changed the way maybe you view life.
Oh, wow. That's a good one. No one's ever asked me that before.
It's an important one. We need to reflect on it.
It is.
Because I know how I got to poetry. Mm-hmm. It was a woman. It was a woman. A woman broke my heart, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Part of my story involves a woman. But to be truthful, if I was to go way back when I was maybe 10,
mm-hmm.
when I was, that's when hip hop was emerging for us at the time. I was listening to rappers like Run DMC, Curtis Blow, all these guys, all these cats. These guys are like, I guess, like Afrika Bambaataa and those guys. They were like the forefathers of hip hop. And I used to try to write my own lyrics,
right,
at the time.
Yeah.
And then I stopped.
Yeah.
I stopped for many years. I got into sports and things like that. I was always very good at writing. When it came down to like English exams,
mm-hmm.
they came very easy to me.
Yeah.
The reading and comprehension came very easy to me. And I always wrote very well. So as the years went on, I hey Max. Sorry, Max just came in the room. So as the years went on, I was a part of this program called CRLT at Dawson College.
Right.
And CRLT, that's where I learned a lot of my, a lot of what I'm doing now with working as a special education technician in schools.
And remind us what CRLT is, creative, recreational?
Yes.
Leadership?
Community Recreation Leadership Training.
There we go.
However, it has a creative component to it. So I have to break down what CRLT is. So community, we're all a part of some community.
Yeah.
Whether it's the community of Montreal, you and me, the community of Côte de Neige, where we grew up.
Yeah.
And those communities have little communities within them as well.
Yeah, micro communities.
So exactly. So where I grew up was more like the Courtrai area, and you had Barclay, and you had the Mackenzie King Park area over there, and all these different pockets. So everybody, we all come from a community.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody needs recreational activities. We all need leisure time. We need to be able to do something with our lives to distract or to keep us in shape or to keep us sane.
Yeah.
Leadership. There's a huge leadership component. So they teach us different styles of leadership, how to lead, how to follow as well, because good leaders know how to follow as well.
Yeah.
And well, the training is pretty just
pretty straightforward.
Self-explanatory.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we learned a lot about nature. We went out into the woods. We learned to camp. We learned to build fires, sing songs, play games, nature games, everything nature-based. Learned how to make paper.
Okay.
All those kinds of things.
Right.
The thing is, I noticed that a lot of my fellow students were very creative. Guitarists, musicians in general, some poets, not many rappers. I didn't see many rappers, but a lot of creative people.
Yeah.
And that's where I started to get my creativity for poetry again. My mom wrote some poetry as well, so I read some of hers. And getting back to the girl of the whole situation,
right?
I was dating this woman who lived in Winnipeg at the time. And, well, I told you I was dealing with issues of infidelity.
Right.
And those things. This was before my therapy days.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make it up to her because I screwed up
right
again. So I wrote my first poem for her.
Okay.
And I wrote another one after that. I wrote two poems. They were very, how should I say, very basic. Like, will you be my lady? I promise I won't be shady. Kind of thing. <you know? laughs>
Right.
And from then, I got the bug. So I started listening to more poetry, listening to albums. I started getting books of poetry. I started reading a lot of classics, Lord Byron, William Shakespeare. At this time, I had moved to Winnipeg because of the girl.
Yeah.
And things didn't work out very well between us. So okay. I ended up moving out and getting my own apartment out there. The thing about Winnipeg is when you're in a town like that, there's nothing else to do. There's actually, there's nothing to do.
Okay.
So I wrote a lot of poetry. I watched a lot of movies, listened to a lot of music. And I was also very inspired by other poets that lived out there. It's a very, very artistic sound. Artistic town. Very underrated artistic town.
Okay.
A lot of artistic talent out there in anything, in visual arts, in music. I was hanging out with this guy out there by the name of Ebo. He was a music producer. And it was the first time I got to see how somebody just off of one little sound made this whole arrangement off of a four-track recorder. And a lot of these things were inspiring me. He was also teaching me how to rap at the time. I never classified myself as a rapper.
Yeah.
Always a poet. But he did teach me how to rap, which helped a lot with my poetry. Before I got out to Winnipeg, I did my first performance here at the Soul Shack.
Which I remember the Soul Shack.
Yeah. That was like maybe the first spoken word poetry show that I ever heard about in Montreal at the time. And I did my performance. I went up. My back was to the crowd. And I talked into the mic. And my voice reverberates towards the audience, and I could feel like everybody, like, whoa, you know, like this guy's voice is like, okay, we need to hear what he has to say.
Yeah.
And I just felt this from my back. Like, I didn't even look at them. I was all very nervous. So like, I put my back to them at first, and I'm like, what's up, Montreal? And I just heard, whoa. So then I turned around, I did my poem. It was first a conscious piece. And then I did a love piece. And I know you remember that one, Making Chocolate Love.
Right.
I used to do it all the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, everybody liked it at that point. So that's when I knew I could do this. It's changed my life in so many ways that it's gotten me to travel a bit. I did shows in Winnipeg. I did shows in Nova Scotia. Went to some, well, I didn't travel like abroad far or anywhere like that. Did shows in Toronto, things like that.
Yeah.
Got to meet a lot of interesting people. I remember that's how we met. We met at Coco Cafe. Just not too long after I moved back to Montreal from Winnipeg.
Yeah.
So it's created a lot of lasting friendships for me, I find, with like Corey Edwards, Fabian, all these guys, Catalyst, Rowan Higgins. But the one guy who inspired me the most, I would say, would be Stephen Thomas.
Yeah.
I always looked up to him. That guy was, even before I knew he was a poet, I'd look at him and I'd be like, this guy is just, he's an amazing dude, you know? And then when I heard he did poetry and then I heard his stuff, I'm like, damn, he's so good. And I would always try to aspire to be like him. But eventually I learned I got to be myself.
You got to be yourself, yeah.
Yeah. So there was him. There was another poet I met in Winnipeg named Anthony. And he was amazing. He taught me that my poetry could mean anything. I could do whatever I want with it. You know, so he picked up a videotape and he goes, this is your poetry. You can bend it. It can disappear. It can come back. You can do whatever you want with it.
Yeah.
Just those words alone set me on a tirade on what I can do to write. Now, my writing has gone to a level that is, I guess, so much more clearer. I'm writing less abstract, but more clear, I guess you could say, for lack of a better word. There was also a time that I stopped writing, especially around the time when I had kids.
Yeah.
I remember you were saying, oh, you got to come back on the scene. it was about that, I guess, 7 year span that I just couldn't write anything. And I was hating everything that I write. So now I'm doing it a lot more. I'm doing it because I love doing it, not because I have to, which is even better for me. I'm putting out pieces when I want to. I don't feel pressure to put out pieces and things like that. Yeah. So it's changed my life a lot. It's really gotten me to see things differently, to see the things that I'm doing differently, to write about the things that I'm going through, and then reading them back and then learning about myself through them as well. And most of all, I really, really love reading my peers' poetry and supporting theirs as well. I think that's a huge thing for me. I just love watching my friends succeed and my friends do things, and just bigging them up, you know, and even if it's just like a like or putting fire down or whatever that like that on Instagram.
Yeah.
So poetry has really, really been so good to me. Mentally, I wouldn't say financially. I'm more like a broke poet, but when you love it that much, you know, the financial aspect of it doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it's really for the love and just doing it because that's what you love to do, basically. So
we are coming to the end of the show, but I want to ask you, if you could say one thing to your younger self right now, you could go back in time and you could stand up in front of your younger self and say, hey, take this piece of advice with you. What would you say to your younger self?
Oh, it's funny you asked me that, because the one thing that came to my mind, all of those toys that I bought back in the day, I would have bought two. I would have kept one in the box and have the other one to play with.
All right. Thank you so much.
That's weird, but
hey. It may be weird, but it's the first thing that came to your mind, and it's natural. So,
yes.
So you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. If you could go back in time, tell your younger self, whatever toys you're buying, buy two of them, keep one in the package, and play with the other one, so that you can maybe sell it for $1 million on eBay in the future.
Exactly.
Jason Steele, poet Joseph, thank you so much, brother, for coming and talking to us about mental health. I know that's not a topic that is very prevalent in our community, especially. It's an honor for me to be able to have this conversation with you. Sometimes we cover topics that are not easy to talk about, but you make it smooth, just like your voice.
thank you, and Kim, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, I just want to big you up for all the good that you're doing as well, man. So
thank you.
Man, thanks for having me here.
I appreciate that very much. Just in case you're tuning in for the first time, you're going to have to come on, go on to the website at ckut.ca/archive to listen to the show at 8:31. It will be up. You were listening to Soul Perspectives. My name is Kim Dominique Ferguson, and you have been on CKUT 90.3 FM.
So I live to see another day. All I think about if I was just to run away, would I come back to love you? No.
Pretending the game is away, because you're born and you died in my heart. I don't wanna change the world, I only wanna stop pretending. What you say, come again, what you say, come again now.
Data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the community contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
McGill University's 4th annual Queer History Month is taking place this October. Join in later in the month for more exciting programming, including a chat with an elder session from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th, a zine-making workshop on Thursday, October 21st from noon to 2 p.m., a trans and non-binary in academia panel discussion on Wednesday, October 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., and finally a queer open mic night with performances by Opera Queens on Thursday, October 28th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. Queer History Month will be opened and closed by Elder Gawenodas Sedalio Fazio. Visit the Equity at McGill webpages, www.mcgill.ca/equity, for a complete list of Queer History Month events organized by McGill's Office of the Provost and Vice Principal Academic and their partners. The goal of McGill's Queer History Month is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
Hi, everybody, listening to the Romanian radio show in Montreal, Marca Ro. Ascultați emisiunea de radio Marca Ro pe 90,3 FM CKUT.